Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4, for Spring Semester 2020. Lecture 23, delivered on April 20th.
Tonight, capital budgeting. That's a fancy way of deciding whether or not we are going to take on a project. Bear with me one moment here. I forgot to turn on my podcasting. Let's try that again. Ah, good. Try that again. Tonight, capital budgeting. Do you notice how I lowered my voice there? I think it sounds more officious. Capital budgeting. That is a fancy way of saying deciding whether projects within a company are a go or a no-go. This is actually important to you, whether or not you are a finance major, to the extent that if you are, let's say, involved in marketing, you may have a marketing campaign that you think is a real home run. It's going to cost about $8.6 million, but then it creates incremental cash flows. In other words, it adds to existing cash flows of the company. And you say, well, we want to have this project go. It will come through the finance people, and they will decide whether it's a go or a no-go based upon these analytical tools that you will learn here tonight. So it's worth it for you to know how it is that the decision is made, whether it's a yes or a no. You might be in operations management. We have this new technology that we want to bring into the company. And it's going to save us all of this money. Well, here again, you'll say, okay, it's going to cost this new technology that we want to bring online. It's going to cost us $1.8 million. And it will have incremental savings of this amount of money over the next, say, 6 years. That's our job in finance to decide whether this is a yes or a no. And if it is a yes, well, then you go ahead with it. If it's a no, then it goes back, and in general, you would want to find ways to make the project have more positive cash flows to counterbalance against the negative cash flow that happens at the beginning. That's capital budgeting. And the decision-making process isn't that difficult. And on a TI-83 calculator, it is really easy. And in Excel, it is quite easy, although the Excel has a little dodgy thing in it that's kind of odd, but there's that. I'll cover how you do this in Excel on Wednesday, but tonight I'll do it on the TI-83, which reminds me, I had something happen in my class, my investments class today, that I had not had happen before. So I'm going to ask you to please put something up in chat. I'm going to bring screen share my TI-83 virtual here, and I want to see if you actually can see the thing. Wait. I got to do something here. I can't even see this stupid thing right now. Okay, let me try this. Can just send me something in the chat window. Can you see this thing? Okay. Come on, really? Yes. That's weird. That's really weird because they couldn't see it. Oh, wait a minute. I wonder if they were just... I smell something. Let me stop sharing that for a minute. Okay. All that off the side. Let's have a quick look at the markets before we go on here. That's interesting. I wonder if I was being played. Okay. Anyway, share a screen, look at the markets here for just a quick moment and see how it did today. And as you can see, it was another down day. The dead cat is still dead. It is lying there on the ground waiting for someone to resuscitate it, and nothing is resuscitating it. So we had a nice slide of a day. Notice that the Dow, the biggest companies on earth, fell the most. The 500 big, huge companies fell not as much, and the small cap NASDAQ companies didn't fall as much as the S&P 500. So this is one of those patterns, clear patterns. We see when there was bad news, but investors took that bad news as being much worse the larger the company was in general. And now something completely different. Something happened today that never happened before in history, in finance history. I want you to have a look at the oil contract. Does anyone at all notice anything? You can say it out loud if you notice something about the crude oil.
It dropped to zero.
Well, look at the actual number.
I'm sorry, -7.
-7. No, you understand, prices are not supposed to be negative. That is so anti-capitalist. That's just wrong. You should never have negative prices. The price of crude went negative. On the front end futures contract, it was no. That is not allowed. You cannot have that happen. And yet there it is, right in front of us. Now, are you going to believe me that it can't happen, or are you going to believe your lying eyes that it did happen? Essentially, that would mean that the producers of oil are paying people to buy it. That's just not natural. And hence why my positions that were put options. In other words, bets that stocks will go down. I had put options on a couple of oil companies, and sure enough, those things, the put went skyrocketing because the companies are going into their graves, pretty much, at least the stock is. And so even in a bizarre market where all of the rules are being broken, the fundamental rules of capitalism, of securities, of greed itself still play out. There's always a way to make money. And in fact, there was another way to make money in this. There is, and again, do not ever, ever listen to my investment advice. You are nuts if you do. For one thing, because I am crazy as a mofo. Second of all, it's timing that is everything. You follow me in, you'll lose because I will already have taken your lunch money and gone out to the Red Robin drive-thru, which should be open, but I noticed it wasn't when I was there. Here's the thing. The shipping, the companies that ship the oil, they are charging insane rates because they've become storage containers for all of the oil that's being produced in the Middle East and everywhere else. Because there's no port that'll take the oil, so these shipping container companies are just filling them up and just pulling off the coasts and just parking there with these loads of oil that can't go anywhere. And so those shipping companies are, the prices of their stock is going through the roof because they can charge whatever rates they want because all of these oil companies that are extracting the oil, the crude, have to get it off, they have to put it somewhere. Their own storage tanks are way glutted full, and now we've got all this oil on the high seas going nowhere. So if this, hence, the price of oil is going down through the floor. It's negative because the sellers of oil are willing to pay someone to take it. That's basically kind of a little simplified, but that's basically what's going on. And so, well, there's going to be a rise in oil prices. This is going to be tomorrow. OPEC's going to get together and they're going to raise the price of oil, cut production. Wouldn't matter, even if they really did mean it, which they don't, because they are all rivals. They all know each other will cheat if they cut production
Even if that were the case, there is months of oil supply parked in the reserve tanks, parked in these giant dirty, they call them dirty containers because they got crude oil. They're dirty as opposed to a clean container ship. There's dirty oil in there. So, I mean, it's like there's no place to put it. And it will continue to glut the market for months, even if oil production were to be cut dramatically tomorrow. That won't matter. It will still be a situation where there will be an oil glut for months. This is what finance and economics can do for you. Walking your way through problems and thinking about, first of all, this is called top-down analysis. In other words, we think from the global economy and from national economies. And then where are they? What's going on? Good, bad, whatever. Then we go down to the industry level and we say, all right, what industries do well in this kind of an economic environment? What industries do badly in an economic environment like this? Then you go down to the company levels. On the good side, you look for companies, stocks to buy or to buy call options on. On the bad side, you look for companies that are going to be creamed by the disaster of the economy if it's a bad economy. If it's a good economy, there's companies that don't do well. But so, you know, you think about what kinds of companies there are. From this analysis, you can find lots and lots of companies that are worthy investments. And I mean, it's awful to say it, but I actually bought positions in a company that makes caskets. Now, if that isn't, I guess I feel bad about it, but I did make money. But you also think about, well, everyone's staying at home. What kinds of industries would do well in an environment like that? Well, maybe gaming companies or companies that make games or sell games, online services. They would do well in this kind of a terrible environment. What would do badly? Well, a lot of companies will do badly when everyone has to stay at home, like restaurant companies that control or holding companies for restaurants would do badly in an environment like this. Companies that are involved in the race for a cure and for treatments or for detection, they'll do fine. And you know what? We're going to have to stop here for one moment, because Gabriel was hiding and now he decides he wants out. So say goodbye, Gabriel. Give me a minute here. Gabriel. You don't appreciate how important it is to maintain seriousness when you are trying to teach finance at a major public university. Out, cat. And don't knock on the door wanting to come back in. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Anyway, moving on to tonight's subject and coming away from this, but notice interestingly enough, I mean, gold sucked today, silver sucked. It's very much one of those environments where a lot of money is being pulled out of investments in stocks, being pulled out of investments in bonds. Well, let me have a quick look at the bond market here. Yep, see, the bond market, money was being pulled out. See how the price of the 10-year benchmark bond went down? Bond money, money's coming out of bonds. So the question would be, where's it going? Well, it's going into cash. Cash is kind of a generic term for very short-term, very safe, highly liquid things, like cash, like money cash, or like treasuries that can quickly be turned back into cash money, liquidated. The markets are just that skittish right now. And yes, we may very well be at the bottom of this market. In other words, what you're seeing, we may have found the floor. It might have been around 19,000 on the Dow and things like that. That does not mean that it's good times ahead. Let's all celebrate. The stock market's going to go up. Everyone's got a job when the shelter-in-place orders are ended and all that. No, it just means that we have hit one of the points that is a bottom, and we're going to bounce along on that. the market is still, it's like its nerves have been clawed raw. There is going to be skittishness. There will be very hard down days, but there will also be up days. One thing that I can tell you, look at this guy right here. This is actually an index, and you can bet on this index. You can actually ride this and invest on this. This one actually is a metric of volatility. It goes up when volatility in the market goes up. It goes down when volatility in the market goes down. So as you can see, that one is on the rise, that high state of uncertainty. And it's getting, it just keeps getting higher, that sense of uncertainty. So we are not out of the woods by any means. In fact, we're now in almost like the PTSD thing. We're afraid of what's coming next. Anything that is another negative is probably going to send the market spiraling down again. Positive news will send it back up. In other words, the market's going to be jittery, hopping up and down. In a way, the market right now is sort of like one of those little poodles. Instead of some big old St. Bernard, it is extremely touchy. Anything will make it move. For traders like me, that's good news. All of this, by the way, is to give you a sense of some of what some people do in finance. It's very interesting to some people. They really like it. It's the kind of thing, I want to do this with my life. Other people say, that is not what I want. But I want to introduce that to you because we're supposed to try to find the people who attenuate to this kind of stuff and let them know this is one of the things that we do in finance. There are a lot of other things we do, and you're going to see one of those tonight. This topic tonight, capital budgeting, is definitely not about investments in stocks and bonds. It's about investments in projects for a company. In many ways, stop the share. In many ways, this is like the stock market in the sense that a company investing in a new project is very similar to an investor investing in a new security. Is this going to benefit me? Is this stock going to rise? And as such, is it going to make the value of my portfolio go up? If we think of a corporation as a portfolio of projects with lots of support staff to keep those projects rolling, then accepting a new project is an exercise in determining whether that project in the portfolio that is the company will add value to that portfolio, or will it detract from the value of that portfolio. Now, with stocks, there's not a whole lot to prediction is, your guess is, well, no. Essentially, there's a lot of it that is luck, pure luck in stocks. I just got a message. My audio is choppy. How is it now? Is it choppy right now, or is it still kind of dodgy? Anyone will give me a heads up on it. I'm probably going to have to. Okay. What I'll have to do, I've got professional microphones, the ones with the boom mics that hang like in the studios, and I may just have to set one of those up. I got a really nice Samson that would do the job because this webcam seems to be sensitive to voice, especially if the voice is hitting right on that little tiny high gain mic there that's there. I suppose it's good if you're doing TikTok videos. And I was wondering, would it work to do a TikTok video of a finance lecture? It's possible. I mean, it could go viral, hell. I'll put that on the back burner. You have your agents call my agent and we'll work out the details of it. I guess in this environment, with this market going down the way it is, I think Taylor's song Shake It Off would be pretty apt, except for the touchy investors who've become bankrupt. They probably wouldn't want to shake it off. But hang on.
That wasn't me using my vape. It wasn't. That's just humidity in the air. Where the hell was I? Someone just wrote, a lot of things you do could go viral. Yeah, and some of them would get me arrested or fired. That's okay. Where the hell was... Oh, here's the thing. You see, we need in business, there's this idea that things are done by gut, by instinct. And to a large extent, back a long time ago, there was instinct and gut involved. But it was always, it was informed by knowledge that went back a long time. Some of my former students see the way I trade and how I just every day I'm getting things that mostly do well. And they say, this is just instinct, isn't it? No, this is maybe 2 seconds of decision that's backed by decades of math and studying and all that. So in that same regard, a long, long time ago, companies made decisions on whether or not to do something based upon partly just gut. And sometimes using for very wrong math techniques. There was one that was very popular for hundreds of years, and it's still used to this day by some companies. It's called the payback period method. And I think we mentioned in the book, it is so wrong, and yet it's still popular because it's a quick, very easy way to decide whether a project is a go or a no-go. Essentially, with the payback period technique, you say, all right, this project, and I'll just show you a quick, dirty, really simple example. Year cash flow. Year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. In the first year, you're going to kick out $500. In year 1, you'll bring in 100, and then you will grow pace up to 300, and then you will make it to 500. And then at the end, you'll have maybe $100 of cash, of money revenue from selling off last year's inventory. And I put 150 there because you should always include salvage value. And I'm going to harp on that more down the road here, and maybe in this lecture or at least the next one. A lot of companies don't consider the salvage value. They just kind of dismiss it. And that can be very bad because, you see, sometimes companies have, there's residual value. At the end of a project, you've got stuff. And you could sell that. Also, worse yet, though, in some cases, in a lot of cases, in fact, at the end of a project, you don't say, well, that was fun, good times, let's go on to something else. You got to clean up the mess. Environmental remediation is a huge cost to closing down some projects. And that is a negative salvage value at the end. So that what was a positive cash flow, well, we were sold off that last $100 of inventory. Oh, we got to get rid. We got to spend $2,000 or environmentally remediate. You see, if we had thought of that at the beginning, those salvage values, our decision on whether to go or no go could have been very different, the opposite. But anyway, getting back to the payback period method, it's old, it's easy to do. Well, this company says, we take projects that pay back only within 2 years. That's all we do. We never take a project that doesn't pay itself off. So in year one, it's paid off down to negative 400. By year two, it's paid off down to negative 100. It's in year three that it breaks over and it's paid itself off. The payback period method in this case would say, reject the project. It doesn't meet our payback period. Two big problems with this method, huge problems. One is, it doesn't take into account the time value of money. This money out here is worth less. This money, this negative 500, is not the same as these monies out here. These are future monies that we have to bring back to the present.
to compare them to that negative 500. The other major problem is simply, well, where did you get that 2 years? Did God tell you that? Well, no, we just always done it that way. And I have literally, in my consulting years, I had this happen, and there's another method that has that little defect in it. Where do you get this threshold at 2 years or at 17% in another capital budgeting method? Well, I don't know. We just kind of always done it that way. And if it was good enough for my grandpa, it was good enough for me. Well, this isn't in your grandpa's world. I mean, 2 years is an awful short leash on a project, especially in this world where these massive industrial projects, my gosh, in your lifetimes, we are going to, we're seeing projects that are not going to generate positive cash flows for 20, 30, maybe even 50 years. I mean, payback period method would never accept anything like that. And yet we have to do this. Think about mining asteroids. Yes, we're going to do it. But it is going to take a hell of a long time before we are actually generating positive free cash flows from those mines on the asteroids like Vespa and Ceres and all of those. And even the ones, even mining operations on the moon. It will be easily 20 years before those things are turning a profit. I mean, there's going to be a hell of a lot of cost up front and then a lot of failures and disasters and tragedies along the way, and we'll get it done. But you can't have short leashes on, we can't have money, money, money right now. This today, I want to make a fortune. We got to think long haul. And in fact, that's the way it is right now. Truth be told, companies like the microprocessor companies, they are in 3 or 4 different development stages for microchips of the future right now. The chips that you see that are in the computers right now, those were started as projects some years back. And as those went forward, the next generation after that was following. And then after that, the next generation. So, I mean, you gotta have long views of our future. It's not gonna be kind of like the 90s and the early 2000s, and even up to near today, where everything was right now. We get instant gratification, instant fasting, and you'll lose weight. Put money in here, and you'll be have a fortune in 1 week. And these are gonna be longer haul, because we're laying the infrastructure for a very new world right now. Just like many, many, many years ago, we laid the infrastructure for the new world for what is your world right now. The roads, the telecommunication systems, the wires across this, and all that. Okay, payback period method. Don't use it unless you're told to. Now, every company is going to have its own house rules, how we make the decisions in the company as to whether projects are go or no go. The two heaviest methods are called net present value analysis and internal rate of return analysis. Essentially, it works like, now, one of those is actually superior to the other. The NPV analysis is much more robust, as we say. It's stronger. And it doesn't have ambiguities in it. The internal rate of return approach has a fundamental flaw if the free cash flows that are coming in the future from a project do something. If they do something that is not the textbook perfect, put money in, then cash flow starts to come out forever and ever and ever. Many times, that's not what happens. You put money in, you make some money for a few years, then you have to add equipment, develop, retool, maybe redesign. So you'll have a year or two of negative cash flow, and then the project comes back with positive cash flows. That's a much more typical scenario. And internal rate of return analysis gives you a wrong answer. You can fix it by using something called modified internal rate of return, but that's a little bit dodgy. It's like they're so desperate to keep using internal rate of return that even when it gives you false answers, they're going to figure out some twisty trick on it to get the right answer. However, let me point out that internal rate of return, as according to studies that have been done of actual corporations, it is more popular than net present value NPV analysis. Okay, there's where we stand on the ways that it is done. There's net present value, and then there is internal rate of return. It's very simple. Let me do a project here. Year, free cash flow, and this is incremental. I need to make that point. I tend to not use that special incremental free cash flow.
Here's what I mean by that.
It's the extra that this project adds to a company's overall cash flow. How much is the extra revenue? How much are the extra costs? How much extra capital expenditures? How much extra work networking capital? How much extra depreciation does this project lay into our company? So incremental cash flow is just saying the extra from this project in isolation. And I'm going to talk about that in the next lecture, that concept of isolation. But in this, let's say that in year zero, you're going to put in a $1,000 investment. Year one, the thing begins to generate free cash flow, $200. Year two, it's beginning to get a market. It's getting some product recognition. And so by then, we're up to $400. And then year three, we've got $500. And then in year four, the project pretty much folds up. Competition has completely overrun us, the barbarians at the gate, as it were. And so it's about time to walk away. And so in year four, we have a $175. And that includes $75 of salvage value. In other words, let me get my fat ass out of here. There. $175. That's $100 of selling off the last of the inventory for some people who wanted to have the last of this product. And then there was $75 we got from selling off the computers and the patent maybe for it and all that. Now, again, that salvage value can be positive or it can be negative, depending upon the balance of these. But you must include it. And we ain't going to sell that equipment. We just put it in a warehouse. Oh, yeah, that happens a lot. And it's kind of appalling because you see in these places, even at Illinois State University. I'll tell you a story. Don't tell anyone I told you this story. College of Business. There's this place down in the basement, you know, where the cafe is, the atrium, all that. There's this door. Over there, you go past the cafe, go back there, and there's this door. And if you open it up, now it's locked. You can't get there. But inside there is a big, big room. Story is that it's haunted. Now, I'm not going to say that it is or it isn't, but it is. But anyway, in this room, there are all, at one time, I don't know what's in there now. I haven't been in there a long, long time. But there used to be all these old computers and monitors. I mean, monitors that were like this big, these computers that some of them even took those giant old floppy disks that were like and all of that kind of stuff. There were modems, the ones that you plugged into a telephone jack. You know, the ones, I don't know if you ever heard one. You dialed up your internet provider. Beep, beep, boop, boop, boop. Bing, bong, bing, bong. And then all that stuff was in there. You see, that was salvageable. In other words, at the time it was retired, it was decommissioned. It could have been sold. Or hell, it could have been donated to schools because it was older technology at that time. Now it's useless. But at the time, it could have been, something could have been done with it. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that whether or not a company does sell off and bring money in that last year from decommissioned equipment, property, plant, and equipment. That's irrelevant. It could have. And so if it doesn't, it's an opportunity cost. They've given up something that they could have had. So you need to make sure that salvage value is a part of any project cash flow analysis. When you put these down, it's not the negative 1,200, 400, 500, 175, 100, because you have to put in that salvage value right there. Don't ever forget that. Now, I think the problems that you have in the book, and I had a couple in there, and it looks like they've been booted out. The ones in the book don't have any salvage value. And that's an unfortunate thing because it sort of continues the myth that we can ignore that. And in real life, you don't ignore that salvage value. Hell, in some cases, one man's trash and another man's treasure holds. It might not be of any use to you after a certain point in time, but it sure might be of use to someone else. Think about like this. You've got a bunch of computers and you want to upgrade to new fancy computers in your office. You don't just throw those computers out the window or stick them in a warehouse somewhere. For one thing, they're an environmental remediation issue. You know, computers are. Why don't you donate them to some low-income school? I mean, the people there, the kids and the teachers might die for computers for every kid in the school. And yet, no, we're not going to do that. Well, think about the charitable tax deduction you would get for donating those at their salvage value. Anyway, so back to this problem right here. Okay, well, what's a mother to do? What we need to do is turn these future amounts into a present value that we can then compare to that number right there, that 100, that negative 1,000. And so we can go forward and say, let's do that. But there's one problem. If you're going to take a present value, you'll need an interest rate, a discount rate. At what interest rate should we discount these free cash flows? Now, for tonight, we're just going to pull it out of thin air. Well, let's say that we want to use a discount rate for future cash flows to bring them back to the present. Let's try 10%. So we would take the present value of this. That would be 200 times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative first plus 1 plus 0.10 to the negative second times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative third, and then times 1 plus 0.10 to the negative fourth. We would take those values. These are the present values of these future expected cash flows. We would take those. And then we would bring those up to here, add all these up, and then subtract the $1,000. And if it were a positive number, we got at the end of this, we would say accept the project. If it's a negative number we get, we say reject the project. It's as straightforward as that. Now you're saying, but professor, that is tedious. That's just plain not natural. And I know I don't want to see you do it because you do your arithmetic wrong, and I don't want to see that. Well, you're right as rain. And in fact, the TI-8384 calculator has a way to do this problem. It's in the finance apps. It's called the NPV app. Now I'm going to bring up here. And if you can't see the calculator when I bring it up, you give me a put it up in the chat window. Share. So here we go. Now you might want to write this down. Of course, it'll be in the YouTube video of this lecture. Apps, finance, or finance if you're from Decatur. And look right there, there's an NPV at 7. Just key in the number 7 and hit enter, or just drop down to 7 and hit enter. and you come back to the main screen. Now, the first thing you want to do is you're going to put in the negative $1,000. Now, put in a comma. Now, here's where you can get error, is you've got to make sure that you use the commas, and when you, now you're going to put in the interest rate. This is an app, so you'll put in the percent, 10. Now you're going to put in another comma. The commas are what tell this calculator that we are finished with something and something new is going to come. Now the next thing you have to do here after that comma is you open braces. That is second parenthesis. Watch this, because it's hard, if once you've keyed it in, it's hard to see the difference between the parenthesis and the braces on this LCD screen. But you have to open the braces, because what these braces do is they tell a TI calculator this is the positive free cash flow that's coming at you now. So then in this case, what we would do is we would put in the first one, 200, and then a comma. Again, we're giving you a new value, calculator, 400, comma, 500, comma, 175. Now at this point, you have to tell the TI, we are finished with the positive free cash flows. Second closing brace, not a parenthesis. This is again where usually the mistake happens and you get an error. Now you close the outer parenthesis that initiated this and you hit enter. I got an error sign. Did I put in a brace wrong? What did I key in? Did I put in the brace? Negative 1,000, 10, 200, 400, 500, 175. Let me try something. See if this one is going to do it a different way. Okay, second, enter. And let me take it back up here and see if it wants on this calculator the 10% first, 10, comma, negative 1,000. Enter. Yep, it sure does. Okay, on this one, you want the discount rate first, and then comma. This project has barely a positive net present value of $7.58. In this case, you accept the project because it has a positive net present value. That's all there is to it. What would have happened if I had used 12%? Well, let's go down. Suppose I'd used 8% for my discount rate. And by the way, notice the trick that I do here. Second enter brings the formula back up and you can just edit it. In this case, I'm going to delete and then replace that 1 with an 8. Oh, when you bring down the interest rate, the net present value goes up. But what happens if I said instead of 10%, I said 12%? I'm going to take it back up here. Now, you've got to watch doing this because if you don't know this, these calculators, when you edit, they are by default going to replace. So I can put in the 1, but if I try to put in the 2, it's going to overwrite the comma. So I have to hit second insert, and then it will just push the comma over. And then you say enter. Ruh-roh, negative net present value. So when you raise the interest rate, the net present value gets lower. And if you raise it enough, it gets so low that you reject the project. In other words, in an environment where interest rates are going up, you are going to be more likely to reject projects. When interest rates are going down, you're going to be more likely to accept projects. This is the basis at the heart of it all of why the Fed is beating interest rates down into the ground now, is that this should make companies use discount rates for project capital budgeting that are lower, which would mean that they would accept more projects. Accept more projects, more production. More production, more jobs. More jobs, more people getting money. More people getting money, they go to more stores, more restaurants. Boost the economy. That's the whole point behind driving down interest rates, is because more projects would be accepted because at lower interest rates. Think about it like this. Let me introduce you. This is a project. You're saying, no, it isn't. That's a sock. Yes, it's a project. You see, this is nothing right now. It's an idea. It's a sock. Okay? Now, let's say that we want to decide whether this sock, this project, is a go or a no-go. If we use lower interest rates for that sock, it comes to life. Yeah, it comes to life. See, low interest rates. Its eyes jiggle, it's alive. But if we raise interest rates, if we make interest rates go up and up, that project, which was just a sock, is dead. High interest rates. They destroy projects. They destroy the economy. And they kill socks. Do you really want to see socks like this? You don't even want to wear this sock. You're not going to accept this sock. You're going to say, is this a sock that I would accept in my company? You're going to say, hell no. No one wants this sock because this is a dead sock. It was not accepted and it died of loneliness. Real finance for real people. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.